Still more real and definite knowledge is acquired in the Hall of Wisdom, which is the mental plane. An important part of the scenery of the astral plane consists of what are often, though mistakenly, called the records of the astral light. These records, which are in truth a sort of materialization of a divine memory, a living photographic representation of all that has ever happened, are really and permanently impressed upon a very much higher level, and are only reflected in a more or less spasmodic manner on the astral plane, so that one whose power of vision does not rise above this will be likely to obtain only occasional and disconnected pictures of the past instead of a coherent narrative. But nevertheless, these reflected pictures of all kinds of past events are constantly being reproduced in the astral world, and form an important part of the surroundings of the investigator. The page 156. Communication on the astral plane is limited by the knowledge of the entity, just as it is in the physical world. One who is able to use the mind body can communicate his thoughts to the human entities there more readily and rapidly than on Earth, by means of mental impressions. But the ordinary inhabitants of the astral plane are not usually able to exercise this power. They appear to be restricted by limitations similar to those that prevail on Earth, though perhaps less rigid. Consequently, as previously mentioned, they are found associating, there as here, in groups drawn together by common sympathies, beliefs, and language. Page 157. Chapter 17. Miscellaneous astral phenomena. There is reason to suppose that it may not be long before some applications of one or two superphysical forces may come to be known to the world at large. A common experience at spiritualistic seances is that of the employment of practically resistless force in, for example, the instantaneous movement of enormous weights, and so on. There are several ways in which such results may be brought about. Hints may be given as to four of these. 1. There are great etheric currents on the surface of the Earth flowing from pole to pole in volumes which make this power as irresistible as that of the rising tide, and there are methods by which this stupendous force may be safely utilized, though unskillful attempts to control it will be fraught with the greatest danger. 2. There is an etheric pressure, somewhat corresponding to, though immensely greater than, the atmospheric pressure. Practical occultism teaches how a given body of ether can be isolated from the rest, so that the tremendous force of etheric pressure can be brought into play. 3. There is a vast store of potential energy which has become dormant in matter during the involution of the subtle into the gross, and by changing the condition of the matter some of this may be liberated and utilized, somewhat as latent energy in the form of heat may be liberated by a change in the condition of visible matter. 4. Many results may be produced by what is known as sympathetic vibration. By sounding the keynote of the class of matter it is desired to affect, page 158, an immense number of sympathetic vibrations can be called forth. When this is done on the physical plane, for example, by sounding a note on a harp and inducing other harps tuned in unison to respond sympathetically, no additional energy is developed. But on the astral plane the matter is far less inert, so that when called into action by sympathetic vibrations, it adds its own living force to the original impulse, which may thus be multiplied manyfold. By further rhythmic repetition of the original impulse, the vibrations may be so intensified that the result is out of all apparent proportion to the cause. There seems scarcely any limit to the conceivable achievements of this force in the hands of a great adept who fully comprehends its possibilities, for the very building of the universe itself was but the result of the vibrations set up by the spoken word. The class of mantras or spells which produce their result not by controlling some elemental, but merely by the repetition of certain sounds, also depend for their efficacy upon this action of sympathetic vibration. The phenomenon of disintegration also may be brought about by the action of extremely rapid vibrations, which overcome the cohesion of the molecules of the object operated upon. A still higher vibration of a somewhat different type will separate these molecules into their constituent atoms. A body thus reduced to the etheric condition can be moved from one place to another with very great rapidity, and the moment the force which has been exerted is withdrawn, it will be forced by the etheric pressure to resume its original condition. It is necessary to explain how the shape of an object is preserved when it is disintegrated and then rematerialized. If a metal key, for example, were raised to the vaporous condition by heat, when the heat is withdrawn the metal will solidify, but instead of being a key it will be merely a lump of metal. The reason of this is that the elemental essence which informs the, page 159, key would be dissipated by the alteration in its condition, not that the elemental essence can be affected by heat, but that when its temporary body is destroyed as a solid, the elemental essence pours back into the great reservoir of such essence, much as the higher principles of man, though entirely unaffected by heat or cold, are yet forced out of a physical body when the latter is destroyed by fire. Consequently, when the metal of the key cooled into the solid condition again, the earth elemental essence which poured back into it would not be the same as that which it contained before, and there would therefore be no reason why the key shape should be retained. But a man who disintegrated a key in order to move it from one place to another, would be careful to hold the elemental essence in exactly the same shape until the transfer was completed, and then when his will force was removed it would act as a mold into which the solidifying particles would flow, or rather round which they would be re-aggregated. Thus, unless the operator's power of concentration failed, the shape would be accurately preserved. Apports, or the bringing of objects almost instantaneously from great distances to spiritualistic seances, are sometimes produced in this way, for it is obvious that when disintegrated they could be passed with perfect ease through any solid substance, such as the wall of a house or the side of a locked box. The passage of matter through matter is thus, when understood, as simple as the passage of water through a sieve or of a gas through a liquid. Materialization, or the change of an object from the etheric to the solid state, can be produced by a reversal of the above process. In this case also, a continued effort of will is necessary to prevent the materialized matter from relapsing into the etheric condition. The various kinds of materialization will be described in Chapter 28 on Invisible Helpers. Electrical disturbances of any sort present, page 160, difficulties in either materialization or disintegration, presumably for the same reason that bright light renders them almost impossible, the destructive effect of strong vibration. Reduplication is produced by forming a perfect mental image of the object to be copied, and then gathering about that mold the necessary astral and physical matter. The phenomenon requires considerable power of concentration to perform, because every particle, interior as well as exterior, of the object to be duplicated must be held accurately in view simultaneously. A person who is unable to extract the matter required directly from the surrounding ether may sometimes borrow it from the material of the original article, which would then be correspondingly reduced in weight. Precipitation of letters, etc., may be produced in several ways. An adept might place a sheet of paper before him, form a mental image of the writing he wished to appear upon it, and draw from the ether the matter wherewith to objectivize the image. Or he could with equal ease produce the same result upon a sheet of paper lying before his correspondent, whatever might be the distance between them. A third method, quicker and therefore more often adopted, is to impress the whole substance of the letter on the mind of some pupil and leave him to do the mechanical work of precipitation. The pupil would then imagine he saw the letter written on the paper in his master's hand, and objectivize the writing as just described. If he found it difficult to draw the material from the ether and precipitate the writing on the paper simultaneously, he might have ink or colored powder at hand on which he could draw more readily. It is just as easy to imitate one man's handwriting as another's, and it would be impossible to detect by any ordinary means a forgery committed in this manner. A pupil of a master has an infallible test which he can apply, but for others the proof of origin must lie solely in the contents of the letter and the spirit breathing, page 161, through it, as the handwriting, however cleverly imitated, is valueless as evidence. A pupil new to the work would probably be able to imagine a few words at a time only, but one with more experience could visualize a whole page or even an entire letter at once. In this manner, quite long letters are sometimes produced in a few seconds at spiritualistic seances. Pictures are precipitated in the same manner, except that here it is necessary to visualize the entire scene at once, and if many colors are needed, they have to be manufactured, kept separate, and applied correctly. Evidently, there is here scope for artistic faculty, and those with experience as artists will be more successful than those without such experience. Slate writing is sometimes produced by precipitation, though more frequently tiny points of spirit hands are materialized just sufficiently to grasp the fragment of pencil. Levitation, that is the floating of a human body in the air, is often performed at seances by spirit hands which support the body of the medium. It may also be achieved by the aid of the elementals of air and water. In the East, however, always, and here occasionally, another method is employed. There is known to occult science a method of neutralizing or even reversing the force of gravity, which is in fact of a magnetic nature, by means of which levitation may be easily produced. Doubtless this method was used in raising some of the airships of ancient India and Atlantis, and it is not improbable that a similar method was employed in constructing the pyramids and Stonehenge. Levitation also happens to some ascetics in India, and some of the greatest of Christian saints have in deep meditation been thus raised from the ground, for example, S. Teresa and S. Joseph of Cupertino. Since light consists of ether vibrations, it is obvious that anyone who understands how to set up these vibrations can produce spirit lights, either the, page 162, mildly phosphorescent or the dazzling electrical variety, or those dancing globules of light into which a certain class of fire elementals so readily transform themselves. The feat of handling fire without injury may be performed by covering the hand with the thinnest layer of etheric substance, so manipulated as to be impervious to heat. There are also other ways in which it may be done. The production of fire is also within the resources of the astral plane, as well as to counteract its effect. There seem to be at least three ways in which this could be done. 1. To set up and maintain the requisite rate of vibration when combustion must ensue. 2. To introduce fourth dimensionally a tiny fragment of glowing matter and then blow upon it until it bursts into flame. 3. To introduce chemical constituents which would produce combustion. The transmutation of metals can be achieved by reducing a piece of metal to the atomic condition and rearranging the atoms in another form. Repercussion, which will be dealt with in the chapter on invisible helpers, is also due to the principle of sympathetic vibration, described above. Page 163. Chapter 18. The fourth dimension. There are many characteristics of the astral world which agree with remarkable exactitude with the world of four dimensions, as conceived by geometry and mathematics. So close, in fact, is this agreement, that cases are known where a purely intellectual study of the geometry of the fourth dimension has opened up astral sight in the student. The classic books on the subject are those of C. H. Hinton, Scientific Romances, Vols. I and II, A New Era of Thought, The Fourth Dimension. These are strongly recommended by C. W. Leadbeater, who states that the study of the fourth dimension is the best method he knows to obtain a conception of the conditions which prevail on the astral plane, and that C. H. Hinton's exposition of the fourth dimension is the only one which gives any kind of explanation down here of the constantly observed facts of astral vision. Other, and later books are several by Claude Bragdon, The Beautiful Necessity, A Primer of Higher Space, Fourth Dimensional Vistas, etc., Tertium Organum, a most illuminating work, by P. D. Auspensky, and no doubt many others. For those who have made no study of this subject, we may give here the very barest outline of some of the main features underlying the fourth dimension. A point, which has position but no magnitude, has no dimensions. A line, created by the movement of a point, has one dimension, length. A surface, created by the movement of a line, at right angles to itself, has two dimensions, length and breadth. A solid, created by the movement of a surface at right angles to itself, has three dimensions, length, breadth and thickness. Page 164. A tesseract is a hypothetical object, created by the movement of a solid, in a new direction at right angles to itself, having four dimensions, length, breadth, thickness and another, at right angles to these three, but incapable of being represented in our world of three dimensions. Many of the properties of a tesseract can be deduced, according to the following table. Properties of a tesseract: point, line, surfaces, solids. A point has one, a line has two, one, a four-sided surface has four, for one, a cube has eight, 12, six, one, a tesseract had 16, 32, 24, eight. The tesseract, as described by C. H. Hinton, is stated by C. W. Leadbeater to be a reality, being quite a familiar figure on the astral plane. In some occult experiences by J. Van Manen, an attempt is made to represent a four-dimensional globe graphically. There is a close and suggestive parallel between phenomena which could be produced by means of a three-dimensional object in a hypothetical world of two dimensions inhabited by a being conscious only of two dimensions, and many astral phenomena as they appear to us living in the physical or three-dimensional world. Thus, 1. Objects, by being lifted through the third dimension, could be made to appear in or disappear from the two-dimensional world at will. 2. An object completely surrounded by a line could be lifted out of the enclosed space through the third dimension. 3. By bending a two-dimensional world, represented by a sheet of paper, two distant points could be brought together, or even made to coincide, thus destroying the two-dimensional conception of distance. 4. A right-handed object could be turned over through the third dimension and made to reappear as a left-handed object. 5. By looking down, from the third dimension, onto a two-dimensional object, every point of the, page 165, latter could be seen at once, and free from the distortion of perspective. To a being limited to a conception of two dimensions, the above would appear miraculous, and completely incomprehensible. It is curious that precisely similar tricks can be and are constantly being played upon us, as is well known to spiritualists. 1. Entities and objects appear and disappear. 2. Apports of articles from great distances are made. 3. Articles are removed from closed boxes. 4. Space appears to be practically annihilated. 5. An object can be reversed, that is, a right hand turned into a left hand. 6. All parts of an object, for example, of a cube, are seen simultaneously and free from all distortion of perspective. Similarly, the whole of the matter of a closed book can be seen at once. The explanation of the welling up of force, for example, in chakrams, apparently from nowhere, is of course that it comes from the fourth dimension. A liquid, poured onto a surface, tends to spread itself out in two dimensions, becoming very thin in the third dimension. Similarly, a gas tends to spread itself in three dimensions, and it may be that in so doing it becomes smaller in the fourth dimension, that is, the density of a gas may be a measure of its relative thickness in the fourth dimension. It is clear that there is no need to stop at four dimensions. For all we know, there may be infinite dimensions of space. At any rate, it seems certain that the astral world is four-dimensional, the mental five-dimensional, and the buddhic six-dimensional. It should be clear that if there are, say, seven dimensions at all, there are seven dimensions always and everywhere, that is, there is no such thing as a third or fourth dimensional being. The apparent difference is due to the limited power of perception of the entity concerned, not to any change in the objects perceived. This idea is very well worked out in Tertium Organum by Auspensky. Page 166. Nevertheless, a man may develop astral consciousness and still be unable to perceive or appreciate the fourth dimension. In fact, it is certain that the average man does not perceive the fourth dimension at all when he enters the astral plane. He realizes it only as a certain blurring, and most men go through their astral lives without discovering the reality of the fourth dimension in the matter surrounding them. Entities, such as nature spirits, which belong to the astral plane, have by nature the faculty of seeing the four-dimensional aspect of all objects, but even they do not see them perfectly, since they perceive only the astral matter in them and not the physical, just as we perceive the physical and not the astral. The passage of an object through another does not raise the question of the fourth dimension, but may be brought about by disintegration, a purely three-dimensional method. Time is not in reality the fourth dimension at all, yet to regard the problem from the point of view of time is some slight help towards understanding it. The passage of a cone through a sheet of paper would appear to an entity living on the sheet of paper as a circle altering in size. The entity would of course be incapable of perceiving all the stages of the circle as existing together as parts of one cone. Similarly for us, the growth of a solid object viewed from the bodhic plane corresponds to the view of the cone as a whole, and thus throws some light on our own delusion of past, present and future, and on the faculty of prevision. The transcendental view of time is very well treated in C. H. Hinton's Storyteller, which is included in Scientific Romances, Volume 2. There are also two interesting references to this conception in The Secret Doctrine, Volume I, page 69, and Volume 2, page 466. It is an interesting and significant observation that geometry as we have it now is but a fragment, an exoteric preparation for the esoteric reality. Having lost the true sense of space, the first step towards that knowledge is the cognition of the fourth dimension. Page 167. We may conceive the monad at the beginning of its evolution to be able to move and to see in infinite dimensions, one of these being cut off at each downward step, until for the physical brain consciousness only three are left. Thus by involution into matter we are cut off from the knowledge of all but a minute part of the worlds which surround us, and even what is left is but imperfectly seen. With four-dimensional sight it may be observed that the planets which are isolated in our three dimensions are four-dimensionally joined, these globes being in fact the points of petals which are part of one great flower, hence the Hindu conception of the solar system as a lotus. There is also, via a higher dimension, a direct connection between the heart of the sun and the center of the earth, so that elements appear in the earth without passing through what we call the surface. A study of the fourth dimension seems to lead the way direct to mysticism. Thus, C. H. Hinton constantly uses the phrase casting out the self, pointing out that in order to appreciate a solid four-dimensionally it is necessary to regard it not from any one point of view but from all points of view simultaneously, that is, the self or particular, isolated point of view must be transcended and replaced by the general and unselfish view. One is also reminded of the famous saying of St. Paul, Ephesians 3:17-18, that ye, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all saints what is the breadth, and length, and depth and height. Page 168. Chapter 19. Astral Entities, Human. To enumerate and describe every kind of astral entity would be a task as formidable as that of enumerating and describing every kind of physical entity. All we can attempt here is to tabulate the chief classes and give a very brief description of each. The human class, A, physically alive. 1. The ordinary person. This class consists of persons whose physical bodies are asleep, and who float about on the astral plane, in various degrees of consciousness, as already fully described in Chapter 9 on Sleep Life. 2. The psychic. A psychically developed person will usually be perfectly conscious when out of the physical body. But, for want of proper training, he is liable to be deceived as to what he sees. Often he may be able to range through all the astral subplanes, but sometimes he is especially attracted to some one subplane, and rarely travels beyond its influences. His recollection of what he has seen may of course vary from perfect clearness to utter distortion or black oblivion. As he is assumed not to be under the guidance of the Master, he will appear always in his astral body, since he does not know how to function in his mental vehicle. 3. The Adept and his Pupils. This class usually, page 170, employs, not the astral body, but the mind body, which is composed of matter of the four lower levels of the mental plane. The advantage of this vehicle is that it permits of instant passage from the mental to the astral and back, and also allows of the use at all times of the greater power and keener sense of its own plane. The mind body not being visible to astral sight, the pupil who works in it learns to gather round himself a temporary veil of astral matter, when he wishes to become perceptible to astral entities. Such a vehicle, though an exact reproduction of the man in appearance, contains none of the matter of his own astral body, but corresponds to it in the same way as a materialization corresponds to a physical body. At an earlier stage of his development, the pupil may be found functioning in his astral body like anyone else, but, whichever vehicle he is employing, a pupil under a competent teacher is always fully conscious and can function easily upon all the subplanes. 4. The Black Magician and his Pupils. This class corresponds somewhat to that of the Adept and his Pupils, except that the development has been for evil instead of good, the powers acquired being used for selfish instead of for altruistic purposes. Among its lower ranks are Negroes who practice the rites of the Abund voodoo schools, and the medicine men of savage tribes. Higher in intellect, and therefore more blameworthy, are the Tibetan black magicians. The human class. B. Physically dead. 1. The ordinary person after death. This class, obviously a very large one, consists of all grades of persons, in varying conditions of consciousness, as already fully described in chapters 12-15 on after-death life. 2. The shade. In chapter 23 we shall see that when the astral life of a person is over, he dies on the astral plane and leaves behind him his disintegrating astral body, precisely as when he dies physically he leaves behind him a decaying physical corpse. Page 171. In most cases the higher ego is unable to withdraw from his lower principles the whole of his manasic, mental, principle, consequently, a portion of his lower mental matter remains entangled with the astral corpse. The portion of mental matter thus remaining behind consists of the grosser kinds of each subplane, which the astral body has succeeded in wrenching from the mental body. This astral corpse, known as a shade, is an entity which is not in any sense the real individual at all, nevertheless it bears his exact personal appearance, possesses his memory, and all his little idiosyncrasies. It may therefore very readily be mistaken for him, as indeed it frequently is at seances. It is not conscious of any act of impersonation, for as far as its intellect goes it must necessarily suppose itself to be the individual. It is in reality merely a soulless bundle of all his lowest qualities. The length of life of a shade varies according to the amount of the lower mental matter which animates it, but as this is steadily fading out, its intellect is a diminishing quantity, though it may possess a great deal of a certain sort of animal cunning, and even quite towards the end of its career it is still able to communicate by borrowing temporary intelligence from the medium. From its very nature it is exceedingly liable to be swayed by all kinds of evil influences, and, being separated from its higher ego, it has nothing in its constitution capable of responding to good ones. It therefore lends itself readily to various minor purposes of some of the baser sort of black magicians. The mental matter it possesses gradually disintegrates and returns to the general matter of its own plane. 3. The shell. A shell is a man's astral corpse in the later stages of its disintegration, every particle of mind having left it. It is consequently without any sort of consciousness or intelligence, and drifts passively about upon the astral currents.